Well, good evening. I'm really thrilled to be here, although my body clock is about 3 a.m. right now. And I was hoping, you know, in Alabama we call this the Arctic Circle, you know, and I was hoping to be a little more cooler weather because Ted said it might snow. But in Tanzania it was 98 degrees on the equator and it was summer. So I'm really glad to be here, if I can stay awake tonight. I want to bring you greetings from the Helena Church in Birmingham, where I'm one of the elders. And it is good to be here and renew my acquaintance with Ted and Vicki. I know you're saying, how could they have gone to school together? Because I look so much younger than them, probably. But it is great, those types of friendships that you make there are sustaining through the years. And also I need to point out Rick. I don't know, Rick Boswell. I haven't seen him in over 40 years, but back when I was about 17, an extremely immature kid named Ken Craig stayed with them one summer. And the Boswells have always had a special place in my heart, and I was just thrilled when I saw him tonight. And I hope that today and tomorrow that, I guess my main objective is I don't get Ted fired. I'm not a big name preacher. I'm just a big speaker. But why am I doing this? Well, let me just mention a couple of, several years ago, I was on a business trip in Washington State, and I was staying with the guy that was hosting the business meeting, and we had a dinner, and afterwards, people left, and we were sitting around talking. It turns out that there was a guy there that was an agnostic, that was a friend of theirs. Apparently, they had been trying to work on him for some time, and they were evangelicals, you know, modern-day denominational people, and they were trying to convert or talk to their agnostic friend. So I joined in the conversation, and it just kind of went all over the place. And it was around midnight, and I said, well, would y'all just give me 30, 40 minutes and let me kind of explain how this all fits together and how it works? And they said, oh, yeah, and let us get our son up. And they went and woke up their 16-year-old son. I don't know how many of you teenagers would like to be awakened at midnight by your parents to hear somebody talk about the Bible, but he was a pretty serious-minded fellow. And so I went through this explanation of things, and when I finished, this agnostic guy said, I never understood that. I never saw the Bible that way. That's really pretty remarkable. Well, I'm sitting there going, what's going on here? He's buying this. You know, this isn't supposed to work like this. And I said, so I just kind of went for the gold. I said, well, Robert, I said, well, then do you believe that Jesus Christ is who he said he was? He said, yes, I do. He said, and I'd like to be baptized and have my sins removed. I just nearly fell out of my chair. I was, you know, this doesn't happen with an agnostic. You've got to study all kinds of things. You just can't. Then the evangelical couple said, Ken, we need to do that too. We have never been baptized. Well, now I'm just going apoplectic because that's not what you do with evangelicals. You've got to teach them all this other stuff. And then the teenager says, I need to do that also. So at 1 o'clock that morning, he had a swimming pool in his house. We went down and baptized all four of them that same hour of the night. And basically I said, what did I say to these guys? And that message is what I then started sharing with people, with similar type results. And so immediately I then became an evangelism expert, you know, because of that. And that message is what I'm going to share with you tomorrow morning. So if you're going to come tomorrow, be there at the start. It's not two different lessons. It's one thing. It's, you know, Ted broke it up because he's afraid I wouldn't give you a break in the middle of it. But it's just one big lesson, but you need to hear the start of it. So if you're coming, come for all of it, and if you can't, just don't come. stay home and watch basketball or whatever. So, so I started getting asked to do these lectures, and basically I've done them. I stopped counting over the past 5 or 6 years. I've done them well over 200 times, and I spend a lot of time going to countries and sharing it with Christians there, our young Christians, or trying to help get things started. And I've been to a lot of different countries doing that. And what I want to do tonight is I'm not going to talk to you about evangelism per se, but what I want to share with you are some observations about evangelism. You can't help but go to all these congregations and kind of observe what's going on. You know, what are people doing? What are the, you know, the current thinking and all about evangelism? So that's what I want to share with you tonight, some of my observations about evangelism, and then the message that I use. We'll talk about that some tomorrow. There's a little story I heard. I'm often, this is what kind of reminds me, the story of a little town that sits next to a lake, and it's kind of idyllic, and one guy said, you know, I understand there's fish in this lake. We ought to catch some of those, and we could use them here. They got to thinking about that, and they said, we don't know anything about fishing. And so they brought in somebody to teach them about fishing. They got kind of excited about it, so they started studying fishing and talking about it. Pretty soon, they became pretty well known for their knowledge about fishing, and they would send people all over the country talking about it and studying about it. The only problem was that no one ever fished. They just spent a lot of time talking about it. And this reminds me a lot of the climate that I see around us. We want to do evangelism, and we talk about it a lot, but we just don't do much of it. You know, this is the illustration Christ used. Come follow me, and I will make you fishers of men. It's a good illustration to use the gospel and the things like that to reach people. We're commanded to fish. Go into all the world. Preach the gospel to every creature. And we're told what to fish with. I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation. I just wish we believed that. I'm still working on it, but I'm beginning to believe it. And we see passages like that instruction, I think, is to every Christian, 1 Peter 3:15. But in your heart set apart Christ as Lord, always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. I'm going to frame my observations tonight around this passage. We're going to talk more about this. But I want to contend that the case that I will make is this. I don't care if you've been a Christian for 5 minutes or 15 minutes or 5 years or 50 years. Every Christian should be able to explain to somebody why they're a Christian. They should be able to explain to them why Jesus is the Lord of our lives and what that means to us. And I contend that can be done simply. It doesn't require a PhD in anything to do that. So, why aren't we fishing? Why aren't we doing it? What I essentially see is this. Number one observation is, we're just not doing it. Very few, you know, very few people really, at the end of the day, are doing it. Now, I'm not trying to come here tonight to guilt you into doing it. That's not the objective. I'm just saying that, by and large, what I see is that most of us aren't doing it. If I were to ask you right now, how many of you shared the gospel with someone this week, this month, this year? When's the last time you just sat down and shared the gospel with somebody? And I think you understand what I'm talking about. Hit the wrong button. What are we afraid of? There's a fear. There's A lot of bad experience, perhaps, or different things. But I want to explore this a little bit. And the number one question I'm generally asked, generally tomorrow, when I finish, is, well, what's the first thing you say to somebody? I get that question all the time. What's the first thing you say? What do you say? What's the first thing you say? And what we're doing is we're looking for some kind of a mechanistic approach. Say these 10 things in this order, and then they're just going to jump in the baptistry. And that's what we'd like to do. Is we just want this to be so easy and, you know, some kind of mechanistic thing. So I want to do is share some of the success factors and explore some of the things that I think are problems in our approach. So the first thing is, back to 1 Peter 3:15, in your hearts set apart Christ as Lord. The starting point is what's in your heart. It's driven by the condition of our hearts. In fact, we understand this. You know, Jesus told us, he said, for where your heart, where your treasure is, there your heart will be. Now you think about that. And that's what we're talking about when we talk about passion. What are we passionate about? That's where our hearts are. I mean, we already know how to talk to strangers. If I ask you right now, how many of you talked to a stranger today or yesterday? Most of us have, about something, maybe. You know, we already know how to talk to strangers. You know, and it's about things that we are dealing with, and I keep hitting the wrong button on this thing, but like we might talk to them about the weather or the tires that are on sale somewhere. I got a great deal on tires. I want you to know about it. Or couponing. I almost shouldn't put homeschooling up here because that almost starts a riot in some congregations. Health and safety. You know, my liver's falling out, you know. And we will talk to strangers about things that are important to us. We will talk to a perfect stranger about things that we're passionate about. We all already know how to do that. There is no first thing that you say to somebody other than what you already know how to say to somebody. I mean, if we, you know, have you ever had a complete discussion with somebody about politics? A complete stranger? These are passionate things. We'll do that, won't we? We know how to do this. Or dare, should I say, yes, I have to get into the realm of sports. Football. I realize this is not a football state. But, you know, we got Nick Saban in Alabama. You know, he came to Alabama like the second coming. You know, and I told some people, I said, hey, the NCAA is just going to decide to award Alabama the national championship without even having to play the season. And they said, really? And then we've got Auburn that won it. And so we've got that. Boy, you know, what do you see? You see people walking around with Alabama jerseys and Auburn jerseys. What are they doing? They're communicating that I'm passionate about this. Just say something to me. You an Auburn fan? I'm an Auburn fan. Let's talk. You know, that kind of thing. And I know that probably doesn't happen here. There's probably nothing you guys are passionate about. Isn't there a college here somewhere? Purdue? They didn't make the NCAA this year. But what about March Madness? Are we passionate about that? We talk to complete strangers about that. How's your bracket? You know, we do that. If we're passionate about something, if it's in our heart, we'll do it. Now, I'm not an expert on this. There's people here that could probably, you know, if you wanted to really get into the psychology of how to find somebody and talk with them all, there's better techniques and all to do it. But here's my final proof of this. If you ever sit next to a grandparent, what's going to happen? They're going to show you pictures of their grandchildren. I don't care what happens. Oh, by the way, this is my grandchildren right here. But with a complete stranger, I mean, you're going to have to sit there till you see these pictures of their grandchildren. We will do it. Do you see what I'm saying? We will talk to people about things that we're passionate about. And the only reason that we don't talk about the gospel with people is because it's just not something that we're passionate about. That's the only reason. Because if we were, we would. And we have to use common sense, too. I'm not talking about going and becoming some kind of fanatic and tackling people in the grocery store and that type of thing and just being an obnoxious fool for the Lord. I mean, Paul even tells us to conduct yourself with wisdom. Make the most of opportunity. Let your speech be with grace, as though seasoned with salt, so that you will know how you should respond to each person. So there's some common sense involved in establishing a rapport with somebody so that you can try to do that. And I guess the way I'd sum this up is that this, if the fire is there, the methods will take care of themselves. I don't know who said that, but they were wise. Some wise person said that. So, where's our passion? Why don't we have more passion for the gospel? So I want to just explore that a little bit, and you may have some ideas and share them with me later, and I may refine this thing a little bit. But I'm just going to share some of the ones that I have observed. And I think sometimes that we're missing a sense of what God has done for us. You know, if somebody saved my life, I'd be telling people about that every time he was around or anything. I'd be doing it. And I sometimes think that, particularly those of us maybe that kind of grew up in the church, that we just never really felt the sense of God's justice hanging over us. So that the gospel really was good news. And his mercy really meant something to us. Because I'll tell you what, this will generate some passion right here. And I hold myself as evidence of that. Because for years, I didn't talk about the gospel with anybody. I just went to church and made sure I did everything perfectly. And that was all that was important to me. And I missed the whole heart of everything. But now, I've changed. I'm not perfect, and I'm not holding myself up as an example for you, but I'm passionate about this, and I want people to know about it. Maybe just not motivated. You know, I wondered, what if we said, we're going to give you $1,000 for every person, not that you convert, but for every person that you share the gospel with. What would happen? Think about that. All you have to do is share the gospel with them. I think there'd be a stampede out here. We'd probably be, taking over Walmart or something. Can you see that? That would motivate us, wouldn't it? Now I'm motivated. Now I want to do it. So where's our motivation lacking? And that we've got something even more higher calling to motivate us than anything that money would do. Hang on just a second. Perhaps we don't have a love for the lost like we should. You remember the story of Jesus and the 90 and the 9? You know, Christ gave us this example. What man among you, if he has 100 sheep and lost one of them, does not leave the 99 in the open pasture and go after the one which is lost till he find it? When he finds it, he lays it on his shoulders, rejoicing. That's the parable our Lord gave us to illustrate his love for the lost. We're the one. That should mean something to us. We need to develop a sympathy for people and realize that they are dead forever without the gospel. You are dead in your trespasses and sins. I'm reminded of that. There was a movie a few years ago. I'm afraid to say this now because people go, I never heard of it, because Sixth Sense, this little boy, you remember that? He said, I see dead people. They're walking around like regular people. They don't know they're dead, and they need my help. That's the way I think. Every time I go through the Atlanta airport, sometimes I'll just sit there and just watch these thousands of people, just humanity, moving to this thing at a pace just from all over the world. I'm just going, all these dead people, dead men walking, and they don't know they're dead. And I wish I could help them. I wish there was some way I could reach each one of them and say, let me share something with you that can change your life, that can unite you with this God of the universe, that you can have the hope of heaven and a relationship with Him. Dead men walking. Do you see dead people? Do you care? This is one that just blows my mind. Moses made this statement. What a great sin these people have committed. He's talking to God. They've made themselves gods of gold, but now if you will, forgive their sins, and if not, blot me out from your book which you've written. Do you understand what Moses is saying here? He's saying, take me. Forgive them, and if you won't, then take me instead. I'll take their place. I can't. I'm not there yet. I'll have to admit that. But look what Paul said. I have great sorrow and increasing grief in my heart. I could wish that I myself were accursed, separated from Christ for the sake of my brethren, my kinsmen, according to the flesh. Paul even expressed this type of sentiment. Their love for the lost was so great that Paul's saying, I wish I could take their place. You know, condemn me and let them live. I'm not there yet. But I know this. I need to be working to try to get there. I need to have a greater love for the loss of this world, because these are all souls that are created that God would like to have with Him. And I know what they need. Another thing I encounter is that a lot of times people don't share the gospel. They're not passionate about it because they don't think they know enough. We have made sharing the gospel way too complicated. And I'll talk more about that tomorrow as well. But I can tell you this. It's not complicated. Paul made this statement. And this is what I want you to understand, that the gospel itself is very empowering. He said, and when I came to you, brethren, I did not come with superiority of speech or wisdom, proclaiming to you the testimony of God. For I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. And it's taken me almost 40 years to understand this and believe it. And that's essentially what he's saying in Romans 1:16. I'm not ashamed of the gospel. It is the power of God to salvation, and we think it's everything else. And we think we have to know so much and all. And what people aren't hearing is this right here. They're not understanding about who Jesus Christ was, and why was He crucified, and what is that all about? And that is the gospel message. And people are not hearing it. But another reason we may be not as passionate is because this culture we live in. I'm telling you, it's a far different culture than I grew up in 40 years ago. I mean, I've never seen our faith so openly mocked in all arena. All areas of our culture. And it's really, they're working hard to make it politically incorrect to be a Christian. What's something you once could be proud of, now it's going to cost you something. It's going to cost you to be a Christian. It may cost you your job. And that's not really bad, ultimately. But maybe we're afraid of this. We don't want to be laughed at or mocked as idiots. You know, the Christians are, you know, have two brains. One's lost and the other one's out looking for it. And I know that that's what they're teaching you in college, in the classes and things. I know that. And, you know, you're not going to do very well to try to debate these professors. But maybe we're afraid of this a little bit. And you know, we've got to get over that. Jesus said, therefore, everyone who confesses me before men, I will confess him before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, I will also deny him before my Father who is in heaven. We have to overcome our fear. And what will overcome that is our passion and our faith. But back to 1 Peter 3:15, in your hearts set apart Christ as Lord, always be prepared to give an answer. So that means there's some preparation involved. I've often think of this. I lived in the Netherlands for 6 years, and I'd see these Dutch guys, the country's flat as a pancake, and they all want to be rock climbers. Go figure. And, you know, we'd be at a, there'd be a subway station that might have a wall this high, and there'd be guys practicing on that wall climbing. But you don't just want to be a rock climber. You know, you've got to practice. You've got to do your homework. You've got to study materials and backgrounds and arguments, and you've got to practice. And you got to, it's not just saying, I want to be a rock climber. You've got to put in some hard work for that. It's just like winning a national championship or something. Everybody wants to win it, but not everybody's going to put in the work and the effort to demonstrate that they want to win it. The will to win is as important as doing the thing itself. Which I say here, it's really the will to prepare to win. And so if we're going to be passionate about the gospel, we need to be willing to put in the work. We should be motivated to do the things that we need to do to learn the gospel, to prepare ourselves to teach that. This is one thing that kind of disturbs me a little bit, because sometimes, you know, because of the lack of passion, we're just not interested. This right here is a chart of Pokemon characters. Now, I've seen five-year-olds where they're trying to teach them the books of the Old Testament, and they can't get it through to them, and they're going, it's just impossible, the teacher said. They can't learn this. And they can tell you every character. These are Japanese names. They can tell you every character on here and who they are and what they are and everything, because the five-year-old mind is captured by that, and they're interested in it. Now, the adult version of this is something like called fantasy football. I know guys that couldn't string five passages together to explain somebody the gospel, but they can get in here and tell you statistics on every college and every player and what he's doing and, you know, forever, because that's what they're interested in. That's where their heart is. Or perhaps it's baseball statistics or something like that. And I'll bet you there's a few of you here that could probably run this sucker down pretty fast, too. Now, and I know some of you are sitting there going, well, he doesn't even have that up to date, because there's a lot of results today. But do you see what I'm getting at? Because that's what we're passionate about. So we're interested to do that stuff, and we need to develop that for ourselves. And we need to practice. You know, get together, study together, role play together. You know, build your confidence so that you feel comfortable that you can share the gospel with somebody. In your hearts, set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that's in you. Well, why would anybody ask you? Why would they be interested in anything you had to say? That's something to be considered. An old Irish preacher once said, there's really five gospels. There's Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and you. You know, if you're not walking the walk, you can't talk the talk. Nobody's going to be interested in anything you got to say. If you're living one way and trying to talk and teach another way. But in your heart, set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. What is the reason for the hope that we have? Well, if indeed you continue in the faith, firmly established and steadfast, and not moved away from the hope of the gospel that you have heard. Our hope is in that gospel message. That's where our hope is. You know, as Romans 1:16 says, I keep pounding this. I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God unto salvation. God could have said, go out and convert people at the point of a sword or with a gun. He said, no, use this message. That's my power for salvation. And that's where our hope is. And so when I look at some of the techniques and things that we use, I've essentially reached a conclusion, to greatly overgeneralize this, that we have one and only one method within our fellowship, so to speak, of converting people. One. And this is the only one I found, and it's called the Bible study. And generally it takes the form of this. Ordinary Christians can't do it. Really, you need the preacher to do this, because you got to know everything. You got to be able to answer every argument and know every possible thing. And it usually takes about 3 months at least, generally, about 3 months. And it goes through Bible authority and the church and all kinds of stuff. And if they hang with you at the end, you'll try to baptize them. And that's essentially the one and only method that we have. But I want to show you something. Have you ever seen this chart before? This is an old chart that's been around for a long time, showing examples of conversion in the New Testament. Here's the Pentecost, the Jews, the Samaritans, the non-Jews, proselytes, the Ethiopian eunuch, Gentiles, Cornelius, worshipers, all kinds of different people there, from pagans to what. And what did they all have in common? Have you ever seen a chart like that? Because we're trying to show that you got to be baptized. Because look at all these examples. They were all baptized. But I want to show you another example here. Every one of these examples of conversion took place in one session. One session. Didn't have a 3-month Bible study. And all I'm saying is this. The gospel can be shared in one session. That's not our objective. Okay, I'm not sitting here, somebody said once, oh, Kim Craig, he's trying to teach that you just convert people in one session. No, that's not what I'm trying to say at all. I'm saying it can be done. We have numerous examples of it. Now, so what if it takes 2 sessions? Or 3 sessions? Or 3 months? Am I saying don't have a Bible study with anybody? No, I'm not saying that at all. But I'm saying this, the gospel can be shared. In one session, it can be shared with somebody quite easily and simply. Have you thought about that? That's what I want to talk to you about. The message I'm going to share with you in the morning is essentially the message that I use. Now, with a non-Christian, I can share the gospel with them in an hour. I can do it in 30 minutes. I can do it in 15 minutes. I can do it in 2 minutes. Yeah. I'll show you. If I think about it. If I'm awake. You notice I'm talking kind of loud and moving around? I'm not all this passionate. I'm just trying to stay awake tonight. And trying to remember what I'm saying. And I want you to consider something else. The parable of the sower. Have you ever thought about this? The parable of the sower. This is a great illustration, I think, that teaches us a lot about what Christ is looking for. And it's a good example. And I think it's a good illustration of how the gospel should be handled. So, just to refresh your memory, he said, "Hearken, behold, there went out a sower to sow, and it came to pass as he sowed. Some fell by the wayside, and the fowls of the earth came and devoured it up. And some fell on the stony ground, where it had not much earth, and immediately it sprang up, because it had no depth of earth. When the sun was up, it was scorched, and because it had no root, it withered away. Some fell among thorns, and the thorns grew up and choked it, and it yielded no fruit. Another fell on good ground, and did yield fruit that sprang up and increased and brought forth some 30, some 60, and some 100. Now, what was the seed that the sower was sowing? What is that? The Word of God. What I would say is the gospel. And you think about that. I mean, 3 out of the 4 places that he sowed the seed, he didn't get good results, did he? Now, I think Maybe this should be called the parable of the stupid gardener. I don't know. I bet some of you are gardeners here. Do you get ready to garden and just get some seed and go out and just go, phew? We don't do that, do we? What do? First, we want to inspect the soil. We want to find good soil and all the stuff. You know, we don't just throw stuff around. And I think that's an important thing here. God say, you know, I think part of this, it's a faith-based activity. I think he's saying to us, look, you sow the seed. You let me worry about the soil. You sow the seed. Let me worry about the hearts. Your job, you sow. I'll take care of my side of it. But we don't like that. We want to be soil inspectors. We want to get down and say, well, you know, this soil over here, that person, he's got tattoos, and this one's got piercing. They wouldn't be interested in this. And so I want to look around till I find some good soil. Now, I found some good soil. Yep, that's good. But that's not enough. Now we've found some soil. We now want to be soil preparers. We want to be good gardeners. So we need to get in there and work that soil, and we get it right and just plow it and nurse it and fertilize it and all that. When we get it just right, here comes the gospel. But that's not the parable of the sower, is it? He's out sowing. He's not worried about the soil. He's not worried about the preparation. He's just sowing seed. It took me a long time to realize this. Every time you sow the seed, you are successful. This is what God asked us to do. He didn't say, I'm going to hold you accountable for how many people you convert. I think sometimes that's the way we think. Or how big you can build up your buildings and your churches and everything. But he just might hold us accountable for whether or not we're sowing the seed or not. We need to be sowing the seed. And when we do that, you know, when I first started doing this, I wanted to get a conversion every time I shared the gospel with somebody. You know, I'd get so excited because I was going to lay that out there and they were going to respond, and I'd almost get giddy. And then I realized one day, wait a minute, this isn't for me. This isn't for my glory. And I did some thinking to get to here. That my joy in this now is just sharing that gospel story with somebody. That's what the Lord has asked us to do. Don't prepare the soil and don't qualify people out. Everybody needs to hear this message. Now, I'm not an evangelism expert, but we got some that are running around doing that. And so when you think about this, well, what approach should I take? And one of the big things going on out there now is, well, use your building. You turn your buildings and your classes and your worship, and you make that an evangelistic tool. Well, I think that's just a bit carnal. And it's a bit cultural. Because we're wanting to connect with our culture. We look at the marketing methods that the big mega churches and all are using, and we start trying to figure out, well, how can we use that? And I like this guy made this comment. He said, these methods are modeled after marketing methods employed by evangelicals to create mega churches. Churches' adoption of marketing fads will actually hurt in the long run. Mega churches are the triumph of the generic. By copying their approach, mainline Protestant churches are speeding their own numerical decline. Mega churches have found an innovation in marketing, but these can go up in smoke in a minute. And this was not written by someone within our fellowship. But I think he's right on target. When we start trying to use the things that are designed for us to strengthen and build and edify us to attract people from outside. I think we're making a big mistake. And I've got a little snippet here. If it works, this is Gary Henry, who's a, do y'all know, have y'all, okay. Well, I want you to just listen to this comment that Gary makes. I think he's right on target if this works.
You think about the extent to which we've begun to participate in what has been called consumer Christianity. Today, Christianity is just like everything else. It's become a consumer product. Jesus has become a brand. And he is merchandised in the same way that other products are marketed. These are the days of individual choice and customization of products. You go into the marketplace and you're looking for it. From all the choices that are presented to you by the marketers, we select those consumer products that fit our lifestyle. That is, those that can become a comfortable part of the life that we want for ourselves right now. And trained by the church growth marketers, we present ourselves to visitors who come to our assembly as a group of people that they would fit in with from the get-go. Here's what we say to visitors. Come, be a part of our fellowship. You'll like us. We don't have any rough edges, and Christianity, as we practice it, doesn't have any of the stumbling blocks that it used to have. It can be an easy, convenient part of your lifestyle, just as it is an easy, convenient part of our lifestyle. Come be a part of us. That's evangelism in some people's book. And so our congregations become demographically so homogeneous that our congregations are populated by birds that are so much of the same feather, they would enjoy flocking together whether they have the Lord in common or not. Converts in the New Testament weren't drawn by any of the benefits touted by church marketers now. They were drawn by the promise of eternal salvation in Jesus Christ, or not.
I couldn't agree with that more. I think what we're doing sometimes is what we call painting the pig. We're trying to use things to attract people that aren't really the gospel. I mean, you look out there in the landscape and you see these hooks baited with everything known to mankind to try to get people into your church building. And somewhere in the back there is the gospel. And another wise person, and I wish I could find these quotes, he says, what we attract people with is what they're converted to. And I will stand before you and I will argue with you and I will contend with you that the only thing that we need to be attracting people with is the gospel. Beginning and end. Not our our buildings or our singing or our friendliness or our classes or study materials or all these things that we're trying to use to try to attract people from our culture in. We need to use the gospel. Romans 1:16. You know, we're looking for that magic bullet. That's what we want. We want this thing that's going to work so we can get people in. And I'm telling you, there is a magic bullet, but it's the gospel. We're doing anything and everything except the one thing that God told us had any real power to convert people. And that's the gospel. And just to be clear, the gospel, as the way the apostles use it, it's not our church buildings. And it's not whether we use instrumental music or not. Those things are very important. It's not baptism. That's very important too, but that's not the gospel. Nor is what we do with our money or not do with our money. These are all very important things. But that's not what we're trying to convert people to. The power is in the message. And this is what I want you to really understand. That message is empowering. It's not in our ability. Paul said that. It's not in our cleverness. It's not in our attractiveness. But here's our problem. We're not satisfied with the gospel. We decide that the gospel needs our help. We need gospel helper. It's not sufficient. And the reason is this. We want results. We want results. I'm not satisfied unless I'm getting results. And I would contend that every time we start focusing on results, it gets us into trouble. Historically, and even now, everything, when we start trying to get our numbers up, we get into trouble. So some examples of this is that, you know, we try to make it more attractive. This is a social gospel. You know, let's do things, let's make it more fun. It's like trying to get people to come see baseball games that don't like baseball. You know, you have races and fireworks and everything and clowns and all that, and they don't like baseball, but they come because of all the stuff. We want to make it more attractive, because what can we do? We'll get more people. Like, somehow that's our main objective, is to get the numbers up. Or we'll just institutionalize it. Yeah, this will do it. If we get all these churches and we'll create a central organization, we could get more people. We'll institutionalize it. Or maybe we'll just change it. We're not getting the numbers we need. What's the problem? Our hermeneutic. You know, we just got the wrong, thing about women or music. So we need to change our hermeneutic so we can just get rid of these traditions that are holding us down. Because the gospel isn't sufficient. So we'll just change it. Or what about this? We'll just abandon it because, you know, the only people I was really trying to convert anyway were religious people. And I was just trying to straighten out all of their doctrines so they'd worship with me. And now that they don't listen to that anymore because truth's postmodern, you know, it's what's true for you isn't true for me, and doesn't really matter what you believe or practice anymore. And I've seen this come into our group, so to speak, in two ways how we abandon the gospel. The first is what I call heresy detectors. I can't convert anybody because I'm not out sharing the gospel. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to look around and find heresy. You know, if I look at Alan close enough here, I'm going to find something he doesn't believe is right, and I'm going to out him to the brotherhood, and look what I've done. I am a heresy detector. You know, but the last thing I'm going to be doing is out trying to convert people and share the gospel with them. But now I'm accomplishing something. Now the flip side, so those of us that are revolted by that, and I'm rejecting that, man, I don't want to be part of these guys, we're flipping the other way. And what we're doing is we're becoming perfect worshipers. I'm not going to worship the way you traditionalists worship anymore. No, I'm going to worship better, and I'm going to be a better worshiper, and I'm going to not have to be shackled by the traditions of the old church and all that, and I'm not going to be like you, and I'm going to go out and do a lot of good works and good deeds, and it's just going to be great. The spirited worship. But you know what I'm not doing? I'm not sharing the gospel with anybody. I've just become the opposite spectrum of those guys. I said it's like, you know, you look at Corinth where he's got the hand that's not a foot, that's not an eye, that's not a nose, you know, and God says, hey, I want you all together. That's my design. I put you here. But what we do is we say, okay, all you noses, you come and we're going to start a church over here. It's just the noses. See? And we'll worship the way all the noses want to worship, and it'll be great. The problem is all the noses are stuck up in the air. But this is what I see manifesting itself as a substitute for not sharing the gospel. We're doing a lot of great stuff, doing good works. We'll go to the nursing home, and we'll go to the homeless shelter, and we'll do all kinds of good works and things, and we'll have spirited worship and all. But you know what we're not doing? We're not sowing the seed. We're just satisfying ourselves. We need a faith-based approach. Faith in the gospel. Rather than a results or methods-focused approach. We don't need methods. We don't need church programs. I know people that can't give somebody a cup of cold water unless it's a church program. All of us should be sharing the gospel. And that may mean we have to kill some sacred cows, and I'm just going to avoid that subject right now. But I want you to look at the last part of that verse. But in your hearts, set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and reverence. Wow, I'm glad he said that. I'm glad the Holy Spirit reminded us of this. Gentleness towards who? The person you're talking to. The gospel doesn't need to be a hammer. You know, I've got this old saying that says, when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. The gospel is not that. It's not a hammer to pound people with. Do this with gentleness. And what else? Reverence. Reverence to who? To God. This is His blessing. This is His gift to us. You know, we're taking a gift that God has given us, and we're not changing that gift, and we're now offering that gift to other people. We do that with gentleness to that person and reverence to God. The attitude that we display here is very important. So, I'm reminded of the three-legged stool, and I'd say there's three components here if we want to do effective evangelism. Passion. Attitude. Gentleness and reverence. And we need to know the gospel. And if we take these three things, and let's suppose we don't have passion. You know what? We're not going to sow the seed. It doesn't matter what we know. There's a lot of us sitting here that we just know a lot of stuff, but we're not out sowing. We're not out sharing the gospel because we lack passion. But sometimes we have passion, but we don't have the right attitude. And if we're missing this gentleness and reverence thing, what are we going to do? We're going to take our Bibles and beat people up with them. And you may laugh, but I used to be like that. That's the only time I ever opened my Bible was just to try to refute some doctrinal point. I had no joy in reading and using the Bible because my attitude was not right. But what if we've got passion and attitude, but we don't know the gospel? Well, there we go. We've got passion. We've got attitude. But if we don't know the gospel, then we're either going to burn out, we're going to teach a different gospel, or we're going to focus on growth tactics. Now, in my business life, this is for fun, and I'm not going to keep you here much longer, don't worry. But sometimes I've been called in, I did consulting work for a number of years, and I'd go into businesses that were having problems and help them sort these things out. And a tool I would use would be what was called a maturity assessment. It's pretty simple, really. You think about it. Here's a business. And it's got all these functions, accounting and manufacturing and, you know, whatever, all these different functions. And then you'd look at those functions and you'd define five stages of maturity, from the most immature that they could possibly be to the very, very best they could be. And you'd try to kind of find where they were on that matrix that you'd develop. And when you finished, you could say, well, here's where your problem areas are. Here's the things we need to work on. And these things here, they're looking pretty good. And, you know, and you come up with a plan and strategy for how you could do that. And I was sitting there one night, and it just struck me. I said, you know, what would a maturity assessment look like for evangelism? So take this for what it's worth. I'm going to share with you my view of a maturity assessment. And maybe you'll find yourself somewhere on here. Five stages of evangelistic maturity. These are not scripture. Let me make this clear. This is my opinion, but it may give you something to think about. Stage one, avoidance. This is the least mature. So in this stage, what you want to do here is never share the gospel with anyone. And let others do it. And if the subject comes up, retreat. And I'm unprepared and I'm unwilling to share the gospel. And by the way, that's what my money is for. I give it to church for somebody else to do. Stage two, I said, well, here we're maybe a little, we're not avoiding it, but we're just reluctant. And so occasionally I might discuss religion with someone. Sometimes I think we think we're sharing the gospel when we do that. But they have to bring it up, and usually only when I'm backed into a corner and I'm not very prepared. And really, that's what the preacher's for. Anyway, so why am I even involved in this? Now, stage three, we're starting to come around a little bit, and now I'm equipped. And occasionally, I might actually share the gospel with somebody, but I need a push from somebody else. I've spent some time in preparation. I prefer to assist someone else, though, and I'm still quite afraid of rejection. And that's what our church should do. Stage four is that I've reached this stage where I'm confident. I'm ready, willing, and I'm able to share the gospel with anyone. And I'll go for it when the opportunity presents itself. I've spent some significant time in preparation, and I'm comfortable with the message, but I'm lacking in zeal, passion. And I'm motivated by guilt. And I hope one thing you get from this tonight is I'm not trying to guilt you into evangelism. I don't want to go come into a church and just start beating you to a pulp because you're not out there sharing the gospel to everybody or making you feel guilty about it. But what I hope to do is by the time I leave tomorrow, that you'll be motivated to share the gospel with somebody, and you'll do it for a different reason. And that's stage five, committed. I'm now actively pursuing sharing the gospel with anyone, anytime, anywhere. I'm passionate, and I'm consumed with the mission to sow the seed. I actively seek opportunities to share the gospel. I encourage and try to help others do the same. And I'm motivated by joy. And that's what I want us to try to get ourselves to. We need to understand. And by the way, don't beat yourself up if you're sitting there going, well, I'm a 2.4. You know? Because I can tell you this. You can jump from a 1 to a 5 in a heartbeat. It's just a matter of what you want to do and what you're passionate about. Everyone deserves the opportunity to either accept or reject the gospel. This is what I see the message that God is asking us to do. The power of salvation is in that message, and he's saying, please share this with everyone, and they'll either accept it or they'll reject it. It's not anything against you personally, but this is how God calls people to him, that he's purposed for us to be his holy people. So in closing, I want to say this. You can do it. Every Christian should be able to share the gospel with anyone. By the way, this right here is a photo that was taken day before yesterday, sharing the gospel in Tanzania under a tree. And that lady right there was the first Muslim I had ever presented the gospel to. She came up to me and challenged me and said, I want to hear about this Bible. I said, okay. We sat down and I explained the gospel to her. And 1 hour later, she met Jesus Christ. And she said, I would like to die for my sins. And we baptized her. And she said, I want to change my name. My name is Hosna, and that's a Muslim name, and I want a Christian name. And I said, well, my wife's name is Sharon. And the guy that was with me said, "How about Grace?" She said, "Maria. I'll be Maria." So meet Maria. 1 hour. She saw the Lamb of God that takes away the sin of the world. You can do it. First, you need to get it. Get some passion in your heart. Generate some passion and zeal. Learn it. Know the gospel and practice sharing it with others so you feel really comfortable and equipped to do it. Share it. Develop a love for the lost. Teach the gospel message to others with gentleness and reverence. And then live it. By your example, let others see your service, joy, and passion for what God has done for you. Behold the Lamb of God that takes away the sin of the world. If there's anyone here tonight that has never met the Lamb of God and would like to die with Him in baptism, have your sins removed, and begin to live a new, joyous life, now would be a good time to do that while we stand and sing.